welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kalb, and today I'm pleased to have back as my guest Nick Redfern. Today we're discussing weapons of the gods, how ancient alien civilization almost destroyed the Earth. Nick is the author of more than 30 books on UFOs, cryptozoology, and the world of the paranormal, including Bloodline of the Gods, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, Monster Files, and The Real Men in Black. We've had Nick on before, and he's got fascinating information about our hidden history, which may have been influenced by ancient aliens, atomic weapons that were not necessarily brought here by humans, and other mysteries about how whole civilizations and animal extinctions occurred. Welcome, Nick. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Susan. Thanks for having me on the show again.
So, weapons of the gods. I've heard for years that there were suggestions that nuclear explosions could have led to radioactive skeletons and molten glass, and I mean large areas of molten glass, where there might not be other explanations. And I know you've researched this extensively. What's the evidence for this?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because we're dealing with a very controversial area, obviously, the idea of earlier civilizations before us waging nuclear war on the planet. And there is some intriguing data. For example, anomalous craters around the world which display evidence of being highly radioactive, in high levels of what are called radiocarbons. And also, there are certain places around the Middle East with where the ground, the desert floor, is strewn with what's known as like a kind of a glassy substance. And there's the most sort of predominant areas are like Israel and Libya and also Egypt. Now, this glass, which has become known as trinitite, is actually the same sort of glass that is formed if an atomic bomb explodes on a desert location. What happens is the tremendous heat provoked by the atomic explosion sends thousands of tons of sand up into the air, and the heat fuses the sand together, and it falls down. It sort of rains down in this glassy substance, which, as I said, is known as trinitite. And the fact that we can find that all across certain portions of the Middle East and date it going back thousands of years, that's sort of like a really intriguing angle, the idea that, you know, we have some sort of evidence for these particular wars.
Would any other natural phenomena like meteorite or comets form this type of glass?
Yeah, they could. That's the only other explanation, is the idea that something like a meteorite or an asteroid approached the Earth, and as it went through the atmosphere, the friction of going through the atmosphere would heat it up incredibly, and then when it slammed into the ground, it would be very hot. But the only problem I point out in the book with this particular theory is that we have these sort of anomalous craters and these fields of glass, etc., going back thousands of years all across the planet. Now, if these were random events, you know, just heavenly bodies, so to speak, slamming into the planet, the big question is, why isn't it happening today? You know, you would imagine if it was happening, say, 50,000 years ago in relation to some of these craters, and 40,000 years ago, and 10,000 years ago, and 5,000 years ago, why is it suddenly stopped? You know, that's one of the interesting theories that really there isn't a sort of a straightforward answer for. You know, it should be the case that, well, there's no real reason why, if we had these regular meteorite and asteroid strikes in the past, arguably we should still be getting them. So we could make a case that, in fact, you know, they actually are sort of atomic bomb strikes. Now, the other thing that sort of relates to this is that many of them are found within the Middle East. Now, the fact is, of course, that the Earth is constantly turning on its axis. So, again, what are the chances of all these random meteorites just happening to come down in the Middle East?
One area, yeah.
Right. So that's another issue.
Not
that,
real,
you know,
not real high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there is ancient mythology information that I guess Zachariah Sitchin brought forth after examining ancient texts that two of the Anunnaki brothers waged war against each other. And I'm not sure exactly the year this was supposed to be, but it was probably the last thing they did, because I believe he said they were then called back to their planet by the, I guess, the Council of Worlds or the whatever you want to call it, because you can't wage war on a planet that's not yours, especially nuclear war. It's not allowed. So there was at least one, I guess, story of two brothers waging wars against each other. Is that what you found?
Yeah, that was one of Zachariah Sitchin's sort of predominant theories, the idea that the nuclear war may not have been waged by ancient human civilizations, but by this all-powerful race that essentially had sort of hijacked the Earth for their own use, namely the Anunnaki, and that over time they sort of splintered into warring factions, kind of like, you know, we are, the human race, and waged war. Now, one of the interesting things is that Zachariah Sitchin came to believe that at least part of the story of these ancient nuclear wars fought by the Anunnaki had prompted the legends of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, the sort of official or the traditional story of Sodom and Gomorrah, it appears in the Old Testament's book of Genesis, but it's also described in the Quran and what's called the Hadith, which is a collection of quotes from the prophet Muhammad. So we have three different sources for this story, all broadly the same. Now, although Sodom and Gomorrah were the, you know, the two main ones that everybody knows, in the area where they were destroyed, there are actually five cities. They were called Zoar, Zeboim, Admar, and Sodom and Gomorrah. And of the five, only Zoar was spared the destruction. All four of the others were destroyed, but everybody just focuses on Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, there are some interesting aspects to the Sodom and Gomorrah story that can place it into this, like an atomic war context. For example, if the cities had been hit by something like a comet or a meteorite, certainly back then, you would have no way of predicting exactly where these things were going to come down. And even today, we have a hard job of pinpointing it, you know, down to sort of, you know, particular square miles or whatever. But what happened was that in the story, the main character, Lot, is visited by these mysterious visitors who warn him, in essence, to get the hell out of Dodge, so to speak. And he listens to what they say and takes his wife and children, and they flee the cities, having been told that God's wrath is going to ensure they're going to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And the story is from there that Lot's wife either turned around or turned back and was turned into a pillar of salt. Now, you know, in scientific terms, it's not possible to be turned into a pillar of salt just because you're in close proximity to an atomic explosion. But there's an interesting aspect to this. If you go back and you look at the old original texts, now, in the original verses before the translations took place, the word for salt was interchangeable with the word vapor. So, in other words, you could make a case that Lot's wife wasn't turned to salt. She was vaporized. Now, it's a sort of a bit of a grisly issue, but the power of today's atomic weapons, you know, if one detonates over a large city and you're within, say, a mile of the detonation, you're going to be vaporized. I mean, the bombs today are so powerful, they will vaporize, you know, a circumference of like a mile to 2 miles. There just won't be anything left in that area. So when we have Lot and his daughter supposedly carrying on and his wife turning around, I think it's probably more likely she turned back and headed back to the city. You know, she didn't want to leave. And then she got caught in the, you know, when the city was annihilated. And what's also interesting is that afterwards, or immediately afterwards, Lot and his daughters hid out in a deep cave. That suggests they might actually have known something of radiation, you know, because if you, I mean, an atomic explosion, if you think you've survived, you know, the bombings, and
then
a week later or 3 days later, you start to get sick from radiation poisoning.
Yeah.
So that would be the ideal place for them to hide out if they had an understanding to a degree of what radiation is and how it can affect us.
So what is your theory about the angels that visited Lot? Do you think they were maybe extraterrestrials, or do you think they were actually angels?
Well, I mean,
the Bible says.
It depends how you sort of interpret, you know, these ancient texts. But I think a case can be made that if they weren't angels, then a case can be made that they were part of the Anunnaki. Now, mm-hmm. we know from Sitchin's work that some of the Anunnaki, you know, they splintered into two groups. Some who mm-hmm. wanted to continue to use the human race in sort of like a slave-like basis,
right.
and who didn't have much sort of respect for us. But then there were this other side who felt that, well, you know, this is really their planet and we've genetically altered them and manipulated them and used mm-hmm. them as slaves. Maybe we should just give the planet back to them. So
right.
the sort of prevailing theory in that area is that these were sort of the visitors were from the Anunnaki who were for mm-hmm. the human race. But the destruction was at the hands of the other side, the ones that really didn't care much about us.
Yeah, and then, you know, in the Old Testament, there's also the theory that Yahweh was a Palladian god, that, you know, the idea that because he was in another dimension, that Moses and other people, Noah, maybe just heard his voice, because he wasn't really manifested in the third dimension, usually he would just speak to people. But
yeah, I mean,
if that was true, you know, there could be especially if there were interaction between the Palladians and the Anunnaki mm-hmm. and the other higher level extraterrestrials, it makes sense that somebody could beam down and appear in the third dimension in order to warn somebody and then be mistaken for angels.
Yeah, and I mean, you do have a lot of theories, in fairness, you know, with regard to who these extraterrestrials might be. I mean, the Anunnaki
right.
theory is one theory. And then, as you said, you've got the Pleiades. Some people also talk about an ancient Martian race that may have, you know, laid barren their own planet with their own nuclear war, and then they were forced to move to their nearest neighbor,
actually,
the Earth.
Yeah. Atlantis,
yeah. So
right.
it could be a combination of different types
yeah.
of
there's more than one extraterrestrial race. And
yeah.
like the Palladians or whoever was Yahweh, it obviously Yahweh wasn't the God of the New Testament because it was Yahweh was behaving very differently than the God of the New Testament that Jesus brought in. So these are probably different entities altogether. But,
yeah, I mean, that's a good point you make there because,
yeah.
you know, the God of the Old Testament was ruthless, you know.
Right.
you know, compared to the New Testament.
A jealous God, yes.
Yeah, exactly, you know. I
well,
mean,
in your book,
kill,
you know, the
yeah,
God that's talking to Moses, through Moses to the Pharaoh says, you know, let my people go or I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and then sure enough,
that's
he
right.
does it. You know, it's just,
yeah,
I mean,
like all the firstborn are all killed and you know, the
right.
animals are
yeah,
killed.
The
and,
plagues and everything.
Plagues,
so.
Yeah.
Now, I had watched a documentary some years ago suggesting that the whole thing that occurred in Egypt, including the tsunami, was the result of the Planet X effects, in that Planet X can cause tsunamis, volcanoes, and earthquakes. And an interesting theory about the carbon monoxide killing the firstborn was that if you had the earthquake or the earth separating carbon dioxide or I guess it was carbon dioxide could come up, and if they said that the Egyptian firstborn slept near the ground whereas everybody else slept up in bunkers, and if you had a foot of carbon dioxide that they could kill the firstborn preferentially. Have you ever Did you ever watch that documentary or hear that theory?
I didn't see that one, but I mean, you can actually make a case, you know, that something along those lines occurred, because there are a lot of legends, you know, of massive worldwide cataclysms, you know, not just the biblical flood, but there are earlier flood legends and traditions around the world. You know, Native Americans, they have one. The Eskimos have a flood legend, and the people of Northern Europe, they have them as well. So it's pretty much likely that there were sort of cataclysmic events all across the planet for reasons we don't fully understand. And one of the theories, like that Sitchin suggested, was that this so-called Planet X, every so many thousands of years, comes close to the Earth, and because it has this massive orbit, that's how long it takes. And of course, if you have like a large body coming close to another one, you have the gravitational pull, and that would have sort of a severe effect on our planet if, you know, the gravitational pull of this much larger planet came within a few thousands of miles of us. You know, it would cause just total chaos all across the planet. So, you know, you can make an argument that some of these stories of massive destruction may not all have been due to weapons, but they could have been due to the proximity of Planet X, you know, coming close to the Earth.
Yeah, they actually did every single plague and every single, you know, the what happened next.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the frogs occurred because there was so much carbon monoxide in the water that the frogs left the water.
Yeah.
You see? They actually went in order and explained how the Planet X effects could have been, you know, been responsible for everything that occurred. And then it was interesting, they said that the extraterrestrials would have known about Planet X, and so they would have been able to predict these things, and so it might have been an extraterrestrial god like Yahweh, like I was saying, that kept saying, you know, do this or this is going to happen. Not that the god made it happen, but that the god knew it was going to happen, was trying to use it to get the Pharaoh to free the Israelites. So that was an interesting presentation. But you might want to look for that documentary. I think it was on the History Channel.
Yeah.
I think you'd find it fascinating.
But I mean, one of the interesting things about all this is that when you mentioned the flood and aliens knowing that this was, this disaster was going to happen, is the fact that, kind of like with the warnings given at Sodom and Gomorrah, Noah was told, you know, that there was going to be this cataclysm and should build this huge boat. So in other words, he was warned in advance, just like Lot was at Sodom and Gomorrah. So again, we see kind of this pattern of certain higher intelligences warning the people on of Earth about what's about to happen, you know.
And I think one of the authors that I interviewed made the point that within 5,000 years, mankind in one part of the world, which I think was Sumeria, went from being very, you know, like almost Homo erectus, really not very bright, to having full language, mathematics, you know, all of these amazing things, including evidence of star maps that were done off planet, you know, which, how the hell can that be? You know, how can in 5,000 years humans go from, you know, barely being able to, you know, do anything but wear animal skins and kill animals to having all these really amazing, you know, these amazing things that were found in that area? And the only thing you can say is that an extraterrestrial race was involved.
That's what a lot of researchers think, because you do have these sudden sort of inexplicable jumps of species where they seem to be somehow mysteriously upgraded almost overnight. I mean, a good example is like the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnon people. You know, you have this sort of typical image that you see in sort of cartoons and things like this. You know, the guy in the bear skin with a club in one hand and sort of dragging his wife
dragging
off in
the
cave by the
hair.
You know, but the reality is that both Cro-Magnon man and Neanderthal man, their brains were actually bigger than ours. And we know from their caves that we, you know, that have been discovered and investigated, that they were very skilled artists. If you look at some of the cave paintings, particularly in France, you know, they're very, very good. And also, there's evidence being found of what look like early musical instruments similar to flutes. So they probably had a form of music, and we know they buried their dead, so they understood the concept of life, death, and possibly even the afterlife. So, you know, they weren't just sort of dumb brutes sitting around a fire and leaping around or whatever. You know, they're actually far, far, far more advanced than that.
I read a book one time. I didn't have the author on, but I it's one of the most amazing books I've ever read. And it was called, Atlantis and the Return of the Neanderthals. Have you ever heard of that book?
I haven't seen that one, no.
Well, it's about the time where the it's about Neanderthal history. And evidently the Neanderthals, which I think are some of these Cro-Magnon people that you're talking about, they actually had a device that functioned as a laser that could cut granite, but yet could be put on your hand and not cut your hand. And then it could also turn seawater into regular water. And it could also, this is the most amazing thing, it could undo radioactivity. Like if you had an area that was radioactive and you treated it with this laser, the radioactivity would go away. And this device was reinvented by a guy in Poland in the 1930s and 40s. And he actually gave the device to the Chinese, who were using it to desalinate water. And then the Americans were going to have him come over, and they built him this great big lab and all this stuff that was supposed to be for his research purposes. And when he came over, he was addicted to cigars. And because he wanted to smoke cigars when he worked and the Americans didn't want him to, he went back to Europe. So America never got the technology, which is an hilarious story. But you might want to look at that book. It explains the Great Flood. It talks about all the different floods, but there was one great flood. And in the great flood, they said that there were seven large meteorites that hit the earth almost at the same time, not exactly the same time, but very close together. And they all hit water. And then the water, of course, was thrown up into the atmosphere. And then that was the great flood, because when it came back down, it caused the great flood that I guess Noah was privy to. Yeah. But they said that the great flood was associated with Planet X, because of course when the tail whips around, the meteorites can hit Earth, and that evidently, I guess the extraterrestrials knew about that, because Yahweh warned Noah, which was, you know, the story of Noah. So in any case, if you put all this stuff together, it can be very fascinating. And maybe the Neanderthals were given this technology by extraterrestrials. You know, who knows? I mean, it's technology that we don't have a known way to undo radioactivity right now. At least the Western world doesn't. Perhaps China does. You know,
we can decontaminate areas, but that doesn't sort of, you know, it's not a case of totally getting rid of it. It's just doing the best you can to sort of
get rid of
as much of the radiation as possible.
Technology is definitely really amazing. Yeah. And then why would you have that kind of technology if you didn't have a need for it?
Yeah.
You know.
That's right.
So back in Neanderthal times, evidently they did have a need to undo radioactivity. So, and then the other thing is, and I don't know the answer to this, maybe you can answer it, was there evidence that the radioactivity in certain areas prevented life from being in that area for a certain period of time, or was some other technology brought in that reversed the radioactivity? Like, was there a cleanup?
Well, I mean, there could have been a cleanup. I mean, there are certain parts of the world that are sort of really harsh environments that do have these stories attached to them, like, for example, Death Valley here in the U.S., you know, that has a lot of stories attached to it, supposedly where, like, real-life Indiana Jones-type characters claim to have found ruined underground cities deep below Death Valley and chose not to tell people where they were, for, you know, they wanted the secrets for themselves. You know, they talked about seeing the remains of ancient civil, like an early human civilization in what is now the United States, but dating back tens of thousands of years, and they claim to have seen sort of remnants of statues and pillars and things like that deep underground. And of course, you know, Death Valley is noted for the fact that it's a pretty perilous place, you know, in
right,
with the temperatures and you know, the vast desert environment. So you do find places like that that have these traditions of ancient civilizations that suddenly vanished, and they are linked where not a great deal of stuff grows, really. So,
right. Yeah. Well, then the Anunnaki were much different size than humans, and I think all over the world, including in the Americas, we have skeletons that would match the Anunnaki descriptions.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these stories you can find in religions and folklore and mythology of numerous early civilizations. The idea of the giants coming down from the sky, and, you know, you find the stories in the Bible. You know, there were giants on the earth at that time,
right,
that kind of scenario. And Sitchin, for example, believed that the Anunnaki were, you know, not just tall, but very tall. You know, some people talk sort of 12 to 15 feet tall, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And like King Gilgamesh, who was perceived as like a demigod. And in other words, he was sort of half human, half Anunnaki. There are claims that in the old legends that he was sort of like 18 feet tall, which would be incredible. But in saying that, again, it's, if all these stories were limited to one part of the earth, you know, like a localized part of the Middle East, you could say, well, it, maybe it's just a myth. However, when you find very similar stories with giant skeletons being found in the United States and South America and elsewhere, then you begin to see a pattern developing where it sounds like there actually really were sort of giant humanoids on the planet thousands and thousands of years ago. And with the fact that the Anunnaki were supposed to be these, you know, these huge giant-type entities, but looking somewhat human, but there's been a lot of suggestions that they were sort of, they look kind of like albinos in the sense that they had very pale skin and pale hair and sort of pinkish eyes. For example, a lot of people don't realize, if you look at the early texts, that's how Noah was described when Noah was born. And
really?
Was described in the ancient texts as having like these pink bright eyes and this very pale skin. And that sort of gave rise to the idea that he was sort of a like a crossbreed or you know, between Anunnaki and human. And of course, the fact that Noah lived for hundreds and hundreds of years, which parallels what we're told about the Anunnaki.
Yeah, the Anunnaki were supposed to live at least 900 years. So
And that
makes sense because their planet is supposed to be, what, three times the size of Jupiter or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the gravitational forces are much greater than on Earth, and so they're taller, and they have a longer lifespan because they're, it takes about 3,600 years for them to circle the sun versus 1 year for us. So longer lifespans would be expected.
Well, we know that from a lot of the ancient texts that the Anunnaki, even in the old Sumerian text where they're referred to as gods, one of the interesting things is was that the Anunnaki were supposedly very skilled and learned in the field of medicine. And this has given rise to the idea that the Anunnaki, they may have, you know, began like us with sort of, you know, 80 or 90 years, but found a way to either stop or slow down the aging process. And even today, you know, we don't really fully understand. We know the concept and the process, but we don't understand why at a certain point something is triggered where, you know, we start to degrade and we get older and older. And, you know, you have your 80 or 90 years. But if we could find a way to actually stop this process, then in theory, mm-hmm. you would have something along the lines of immortality. And that's one of the theories for the Anunnaki, that they cracked the puzzle mm-hmm. of how yeah. to hold off the aging process.
Yeah, and, you know, Michael Tellinger's work in South Africa, they may have used their advanced medical knowledge to actually genetically engineer the going from Homo erectus to Homo sapien in order to create the slave race to mine their gold, because the Anunnaki kind of rebelled and didn't want to mine their own gold because it was too much work, which it would be, you know. So they may have been responsible for actually creating Homo sapiens. And then, maybe they were created so that they wouldn't live a long time, you know, because a shorter lifespan does pretty much, you know, assure that you will remain powerful over these people, you know. They don't have if they live one-tenth of what you live, rebellions and uprisings are not as likely to occur.
No, and I think, you know, it's important, that's an important point, and the fact that, you know, like as you said with Michael Tellinger, his work, you know, strongly points in the direction of this massive process to mine gold out of, you know, the African landscape, and also the fact that some people have suggested, you know, the story of the Garden of Eden actually has is like a parallel or an analogy to early primitive entities in Africa. Mm-hmm. You know, the Garden of Eden somewhere being in Africa, and then you have from there the idea that, you know, Adam was created and then Eve was created from Adam's rib. And one mm-hmm. of the theories there is that it wasn't so much created from the rib, but DNA was taken from Adam's side, which is, you know, in cloning, the side of the body, the cells there are perfect for cloning, interestingly enough. And so one of the theories is that, you know, she wasn't literally created from his rib, but that was a distortion of like a medical operation in which, you know, cells and DNA were taken and spliced with an early primitive human entity, and then they started to upgrade them, you know, to where they were not just sort of very primitive ape-like creatures, but where they could do the work for the Anunnaki and have a higher brain power as well.
There's also an interesting idea in Urantia about what Adam and Eve were. It talks about the Luciferian Rebellion 200,000 years ago, where Lucifer, who is an angel, of course, was given authority over 37 planets, I believe, and he petitioned the administration for more free will for these planets, and the administration granted that, according to Urantia. And then this is an idea about maybe why we don't live as long. There was a covering put around these planets so that when we were incarnated, we would forget who we were, forget our connection to, you know, our soul, and then be capable of this evil that occurred. And maybe, you know, maybe even the limiting lifespan, you know, because the ascension, which is the reversal of the Luciferian rebellion, we're supposed to be able to live a lot longer, you know, in the higher dimensional realms of Earth, where the Mayans may be and Jesus Christ and some of the masters of the Far East may be, that the lifespan is actually much higher in these higher dimensional areas. So if you throw in a multidimensional component to this, in the higher dimensions, we may live a lot longer than we do in the lower dimensional things. But the point I wanted to make is that in Urantia, it says that Adam and Eve were brought in for upgrades. In other words, the human race wasn't doing very well, so they brought Adam and Eve in to have sex with, and they both were supposed to have sex with as many people as they could in order to upgrade the human race so it would be more ethical and a better race, which is interesting. So that's a theory. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but that Adam and Eve were actually upgrades.
Yeah, and you can place a lot of those stories about Adam and Eve, you know, in that context of sort of experiments undertaken on, you know, early humans, upgrading them, and then upgrading those, and then upgrading the next ones, you know.
evidently this is done all the time, according to some sources, that, you know, that the higher dimensional beings who are watching over the planets and how things are going will send in genetic upgrades. And how they're done, of course, whether they're done like the Anunnaki did them, which were more primitive probably, or whether they're done, you know, in different ways. But probably we, you know, getting civilizations through the point in time where they are no longer capable of destroying their planet with nuclear weapons is probably one of the things that has to be done again and again and again, because at least some of the planets historically have been blown up by nuclear weapons when the civilizations didn't quite get past that point. You know, they did destroy themselves.
Yeah, and that's something, one of the things I talk about in the book is this process of, you know, sort of countless extinctions. You know, it's not just like, say, 5 or 10,000 years ago. There's some ancient texts that sort of push it back to sort of 15,000 and 20,000 years, almost as if it's like a cycle. You know, we're almost doomed to sort of repeat the past, so to speak.
Well, there's certainly the information I have is that it's not every 3,600 years that we have massive destruction on the Earth. It's more like every 60,000. And so Planet X is supposed to come by every 3,600 years, but there's a pole shift every 60 to 80,000 in the geological record. So it may be that the pole shift only occurs every so many years or so many cycles when Nibiru does come around. You know, it doesn't come so close to the Earth every time.
Yeah.
But that when it does come close to the Earth, the mantle and the core shift on each other violently, and then you get the pole shift with the massive extinctions. You see, that would be it wouldn't be so much on the land, but near the sea it would be very, very destructive.
Yeah, and you do find, you know, sudden massive extinctions. I mean, we know that there was one in what, again, is now the United States, round about sort of 12, 13,000 years ago. There were massive sudden extinctions across the U.S. of, like, saber-toothed tigers, mammoths, and from some of the remains, we know they died extremely quickly. I mean, like, in the click of a thumb, you know. And we don't really know what caused that. It wasn't like, you know, they were starving and running out of food and they died progressively over months and years. It was
they
like
full
in
stomach.
A second.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now, was that global, though, or was that just in the northern U.S.?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say because we have similar stories. You know, we have like the floods in the Middle East. We have these extinctions in the U.S., but the problem is it's difficult to date exactly a lot of these ancient manuscripts. Now, like, for example, the Indian Mahabharata, which talks about something that sounds eerily like an ancient nuclear war, that has been recognized by various scholars as perhaps being written about 3,000 years ago, and some say 5 and some say 6. But then you have others who say, well, it may have been written 6,000 years ago, but it could actually be based upon stories going back 30 or 40,000 years. So in other words, it's very difficult for us to try and place all these events in one time frame. Maybe they were, but the problem is some of the stories have been passed down and people have assumed that they occurred when the document was written, but it may have been passed down orally for thousands of years before it was actually written down, you know.
Right.
So it is hard to say really time-wise.
And that brings up the flying chariots, you know, the chariots of fire idea, that some of these might have been spacecraft rather than actual chariots. So,
well, I mean, that sort of ties in with the stories, again, coming out of India, of what are known as the Vimanas. And the term Vimana is an ancient Indian term for essentially what was described as like a flying machine that, you know, could take to the skies and would take part in battles, and you have these stories of these iron thunderbolts that could destroy cities, which sounds, you know, kind of like an air-to-surface nuclear missile, you know, being targeted at a city. And there are stories also in the Mahabharata of soldiers throwing themselves in the water to cleanse themselves and birds dropping out of the sky, kind of, mm-hmm. again, like radiation poisoning, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, some of the descriptions even say that they, you know, have bloody, you know, they have bloody noses and mm-hmm. lose their hair.
Yeah.
And I mean, real specific
yeah.
stuff scientifically that would be radiation poisoning.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
it really does, I mean, there's hardly anything else that would do that in mass, you know, I mean, where all the people were affected.
Yeah.
That would,
yeah.
I mean, if you had a poisoning, maybe some people could be affected. But
yeah, that is one of the, you know, the major hazards of a nuclear attack is radiation. You know, it's
yeah.
even if the bomb explodes 10 miles away and, okay, your windows are shattered and the roof's probably blown off even at that distance, but you've survived and you think you're okay, not realizing that these huge winds are now
yeah.
coming towards you with deadly radioactive materials of dust, you know, and then
right.
literally sort of 24 hours, 48 hours, you start to bleed from the mouth and the
right.
nose and everywhere, and then 3 or 4 days later, you're
yeah.
dead, you know.
Yeah, that's very true. It's pretty yeah. destructive, and it's just
yeah,
interesting that the Anunnaki would have had nuclear weapons. It's almost, it almost is, and then, of course, we don't even know what the Indian War was about, whether that was Anunnaki or that was, you know, when Krishna is blue, and there are blue extraterrestrials, it makes you wonder if there's more than one race involved of extraterrestrials that were
I mean, the stories of the Mahabharata are interesting because of what they specifically state about this war. It was called the Kurukshetra War, and it was fought in a place called Haryana, which is in northern India. Now, according to the story, it was actually a war between two warring families of Indian people, not the gods. However, the gods do come into the story. So, again, this kind of sounds like certain factions of the Anunnaki helping certain factions of the human race and providing them possibly with weapons and teaching
yeah.
them how to fly these Vimanas and things like that,
right.
Rather than the Anunnaki playing, you know, a direct role. They were sort of, you know, helping the people on the planet.
So. Kind of like we do in the Middle East. we send advisors in.
yeah. Well,
and,
yeah, I mean, you could make that analogy.
And, yeah, right.
it's not that
we want
far
one
off
side
an
to
analogy,
win.
Really.
Right, right, yeah. It's not unlike that. But, you know, it's just interesting. It may be that every time a civilization gets to a certain point, they develop nuclear weapons, and then they have to either survive them or they, you know, or they have these wars where they can bomb themselves back into the Stone Age, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the worrying thing about that today is, you know, you hear a lot of stuff on the news about nuclear weapons and somebody threatens to use this. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, all the major powers on the planet have nuclear weapons. You know,
right.
the former Soviet Union, collectively Russia, you know, all the, but they splintered after the Soviet Union was split up. But
yeah.
collectively, the countries that comprised of the Soviet Union actually have more atomic weapons than the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And China, you know, they have a massive number as well. The UK, France, you know.
And then India and Pakistan both have them, and they're fighting now.
Yeah.
That's great, huh?
Yeah. And, I mean, if there was a sort of a world, there's actually,
yeah.
despite what some people tell you, there is no way to win a nuclear war. It's impossible because
mutually destroyed destruction.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just no way to win it.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Yeah. Well, I heard an interesting theory the other day that the countries that want to get into the nuclear club don't really want to get in there so much because of the possession of nuclear weapons, but because they then are able to get into the secret space program, which basically the countries, the secret space program has been around for 30 or 40 years, and it's responsible for protecting the solar system. So that's really the reason why people want to get into countries want to get into the nuclear club, is because then they have access to all this amazing technology that is in the secret space program but isn't necessarily on the planet. So that might be why that's so sought after.
Yeah, I never really thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Randy Kramer said, and Randy's the
oh, okay.
official spokesperson for the secret space program now, so he's got his Brigadier General's permission to start talking about it. And you might want to look him up. He's got some fascinating information about what's been going on to protect our solar system. He says we're really doing a pretty good job of protecting it.
That's good.
We have different programs called Solar Warden, and Radiant Guardian, depending on what part of the solar system you're talking about. And we do patrols, and we do all sorts of stuff, and we've kicked the Zeta Reticulans out, and we're in the process of kicking the Dracos out. So, you know, we actually have, we're in the process of slow disclosure, according to Randy, so as not to upset people who may be mentally unstable. But, you know, you might remember that a few years ago, Mars had nothing on it, right? And then all of a sudden it had water, and now it has some plants, you know, and that's what slow disclosure is. You know, all of a sudden it's released that Mars has this and that, and then pretty soon we're going to learn that Mars has been, you know, it has had bases and all sorts of, you know, human and non-human forms and all sorts of stuff for years. And all of that's going to be coming out slowly, but definitely coming out. So keep your eyes on that. It may change a lot of what you know about what's possible, you know, because when they really disclose what is, then a lot of the information will be, you know, will be out in the open, and we will really understand that we have been interacting with aliens for a long time, and probably since the beginning of human, you know, that humans came on the planet, because I believe aliens have been coming here even before humans were here. I interviewed the guy that wrote Ancient or Forbidden Archaeology, and there are some artifacts, like there was a silver artifact, I think it was a bowl or a cup or something, that was dated, carbon dated, millions of years ago. So obviously it was brought here by extraterrestrials. It had to be, you know. So just very interesting stuff and is going to be coming out now.
Oh, cool.
So we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Oh, yeah, sure. I have a blog which is called World of Whatever, and people can read. If they type that in, they'll find it immediately. And there's a contact section there, and people can reach me at Twitter, at Nick Redfern UFO, and also at Facebook. There are several Nick Redferns, well, quite a few Nick Redferns on Facebook, but scroll down and you'll find me. And you know, always pleased to chat with people if they've got any questions or want to share information. You know, I'm always always around. So.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a fascinating conversation, and I think that we always have great interviews when you come on. So if there's any other books you want to talk about, just let us know, and we'll get you back on.
Oh, I appreciate that, Susan. Actually, I've got a follow-on book to Weapons of the Gods, which was a follow-up to an early one, Bloodline of the Gods, which comes out in December.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Immortality of the Gods, and it deals with all this issue of, like, the Anunnaki having cracked the code for immortality, you know. So it's sort of looking at how the science tied in with the alien angle of slowing the aging process or actually achieving full-blown immortality.
Well, great. Let us know when you want to do that. I assume you want to do that close to the release of the book, so that would be great, because we're booking into that area right now. So we'd love to have you
released,
back on for that.
I think the official release date is something like December 29, so I guess, you know, sometime early January would be good, I guess.
Okay, super. Yeah, we're definitely, we have a couple of things booked in January, so we'll get you right on that.
Okay,
great. Well, thanks a lot, Nick. Look forward to having you back. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've been interviewing Nick Redfern, Weapons of the Gods. And next week, we will be interviewing Richard Barnett, A New Psychology of Human Well-Being. And then on the 15th, Transcendent Mind by Sunita Pantina. And please join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.